and welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. In a few minutes, for the principal segment of our show, I'll be speaking with Professor Stephen Watts about his new book on Walt Disney. But first, let's look back at this week, July 27th through August 2nd, in history. On July 27th, 1586, Sir Walter Raleigh brought Virginia tobacco to England. On July 28, 1931, Congress declared the Star-Spangled Banner the nation's national anthem. On July 31, 1498, Christopher Columbus landed on the island of Trinidad. On August 1, 1981, at midnight, MTV broadcast its first music video, titled Video Killed the Radio Star by the Buggles. On August 2, 1375, the world's first roller skating rink opened in London. And on August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, sparking the Gulf War. Turning to this week's History in the News segment, the London Times reports that workmen have dug up the remains of four adults and six children at the site of the London home of Benjamin Franklin, and researchers believe there could be more bodies buried beneath the basement kitchen. Officials estimate the bones to be about 200 years old and to have been buried at the time Franklin was living in the house. Further, most of the bones show signs of having been dissected, sawn, or cut. One skull has been drilled with several holes. The principal suspect is not Franklin, however. It is William Hewson, Franklin's landlady's son-in-law. In the early 1770s, Dr. Hewson ran a school of anatomy, and most likely the remains are anatomical specimens that Dr. Hewson disposed of in his own house. And the Titanic is back in the news again. This time, researchers have made public documents that they say disprove the film's depiction of third-class passengers locked below deck as the luxury liner sank in 1912. Nevertheless, documents show that more male first-class passengers survived the sinking than men in second and third class, and that it is true as well that women and children did come first in abandoning the sinking ship. So here are the figures. You be the judge. 97% of women and 34% of the men in first class survived. 84% of the women in second class survived, but only 8% of the men. And in third class, 55% of the women and 12% of the men survived. Researchers explained the higher survival rate for first class passengers as the result of their being closer to the lifeboats, of which there were too few for everyone. And more of them spoke English, thereby being better able to understand the crew's instructions. You're listening to Talking History. He's been called an American icon, the principal architect of mass culture in our time, and the spokesman for the American way of life. For those who have studied him closely, however, he has also been one of the more controversial figures in post-war America. His name is Walt Disney, the subject of our interview in this week's program. To tell us more about Walt Disney, I'm pleased to welcome to the show Stephen Watts, professor of history at the University of Missouri. Professor Watts has just written The Magic Kingdom, Walt Disney and the American Way of Life, published by Houghton Mifflin, which has received a wide range of critical accolades. A reviewer for the New York Times has called Watts' book fascinating, complimenting him on having done, quote, an intelligent job of assembling and analyzing a vast amount of material and turning it into a coherent, insightful book. The reviewer recommends it as, quote again, a terrifically readable and illuminating book. Welcome, Steve, to the show. Congratulations on the very positive reviews of your new book.
Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Great. Let's start from the more basic question here. The title of the book suggests that you've got more in mind here than just simply a biography. What are you trying to do here besides presenting the biographical details?
Well, I conceived of the book, I think, from the very beginning as partly a biography in which I would detail some of the events of what was truly a fascinating life from rags to riches in Disney's case, but I also wanted to do more than that, and that was to provide a cultural analysis of Disney's significance in modern American life. So I broadened my scope to try to situate Disney's creations in a kind of cultural story of modern America as well.
Okay. Well, along that line, you do mention or you refer to Disney in several different ways. Let me just list a few and then ask you to comment on each one as we go along. For example, you call him the principal architect of mass culture in our time. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's evident to us and probably all of our listeners here as well that anywhere you turn in the modern world, be it movies or televisions or theme parks, more recently in Broadway shows and productions, that Disney seems to be there. And I guess what I tried to explain, at least in part of the book, is the tremendous role that Walt Disney played in the creation of those very forms, so with animated movies and later the move into television, the development of Disneyland, and so on. So those are the sorts of themes that I'm coming at in that particular area.
Okay. When you call him an American icon, are you getting away from his creations there to more about Disney as an individual?
I think it's a combination of both. I think the story that illustrates that best is there was a kind of legend at the Disney studio I came across that there were some explorers hacking their way through the South American jungle somewhere in late 1920s and 30s, and one of the first things they came across was a little boy from incredibly out in the wilds wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt. And I think in a very brief essence, that's what I'm driving at, you know, how Disney became a symbol of America and Americanism, I think, around the world very quickly.
Well, that leads into, if he is an icon, if he's a symbol of Americanisms or whatever, what do we mean then if we refer to you're calling him the spokesman for the American way of life?
Well, I think for the beginning of his career and popularity with Mickey Mouse in the late 20s and thereafter as well, over succeeding decades, that Disney identified himself with ordinary Americans and their values, and he explicitly saw himself as a spokesman for ordinary American values, I guess what we as historians would call the great middle class in this country. And I think Disney's productions, as he, I think, pretty self-consciously articulated them from the 1930s over the next 30 years, attempted to convey to the world the nature of those middle American values of hard work, respect for family, sort of the bourgeois virtues, I suppose, in one way or another. So that's the kind of thing I'm driving at.
Okay. Well, let me get back to the idea of some examples of how he represents middle America. But before that, you have a sentence in your book where you've already referred to proclaiming that Disney was proclaiming a genuine allegiance to the values of an earlier age. But then you also end the sentence by saying that he also took the lead in creating the modern world of consumer self-fulfillment. What
right.
do you mean by this?
Well, one of the things that quickly fascinated me about Disney as I was doing the research for this book at the Disney Archives and unearthing a great deal of material was the very complicated historical position he seemed to occupy. On the one hand, he did advocate quite clearly and self-consciously a kind of allegiance to the values of 19th century America, producer values, the sort of middle class stability and respectability and so on, the old traditions of character formation and so on. But at the very same time, what was obvious is that Disney's work itself was part of a kind of consumer revolution in the modern world that was very connected to values of leisure and entertainment, consumerism, and so on. So I think that unique niche that he occupied from one historical age to another, the transition, tells us a lot about Disney's significance for Americans in the 1900s.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have you cite some of those examples, but I can't resist. You mentioned doing research in the Disney archives here. I know you're an accomplished historian. You've been in many archives around the United States. I'm sure that our listeners are sitting there thinking how wonderful it must be to work in the Disney archives. What was it like? Was it any different?
Oh, yes, it was a great deal different from other archives I've been in. If the truth be told, it was sort of hard to pretend that it was work sometimes. The Disney Archives is at the Disney Studio, the Walt Disney Studio in Burbank, California. And it is just a spectacular repository of every conceivable artifact and document and artistic sketch that one could imagine about the history of Disney and his enterprise. And I spent 5 years there sort of roaming through their collections and looking at story notes and the original sketches for Fantasia and old recordings of the Mickey Mouse Club and on and on. And it was just a great deal of fun as well as the work involved in it.
Well, that's great. Okay, let's take us through then the decades and some examples, because you mentioned that you feel that Disney's creations embody the transformation of American popular culture from the 30s to the 60s, and then you mentioned things like Three Little Pigs, Dumbo, Pinocchio, the Seven Dwarves, Mickey Mouse, and Donald Duck, and you say that these are more than playful critiques of the social order. They're more than merely entertainment, but also playful critiques of the social order. Take, you know, maybe an example from each of these decades that we might know and tell me why they meet this description.
Well, I did become convinced that Disney's work was more than simply entertainment, and the first tip-off was, the first upsurge of the studio's popularity took place almost coincidentally with the Great Depression. But it was not such a coincidence at all, it seemed to me, because as I looked at movies like The Three Little Pigs, for example, the themes and the issues and the anxieties of the Depression, I think, resonated very clearly. Three Little Pigs, for example, is about, it's a kind of allegory of the Great Depression, wherein the big bad wolf, much like the Great Depression, is a kind of outside force coming at these little characters in the story, promising destruction at every turn. And what you see in that film, for instance, is that the three little pigs, these cute little characters, survive by learning to practice certain kinds of habits, hard work, producer orientation, thrift, a kind of attention to their interest, and so on. I think it is a story of the Great Depression. And you see Franklin Roosevelt, for example, quoting from Three Little Pigs in a couple of his fireside speeches in the 1930s. So I think there is more there than just entertainment.
Great. How about the 40s?
Well, in the 40s, what you see most dramatically along these lines, of course, was the influence of World War II, where the Disney studio leapt into the war effort and churned out an enormous number of films, training films, and I guess what we would have to call propaganda films, as well to bolster American morale and so on. I think thoroughly reflected the kind of preoccupation with the war in the 40s that took up most Americans' attention. And again, the Disney studio winning Academy Awards for a couple of their short movies about the war effort is right there in the center part of the picture as well.
And the 50s?
Well, in the 50s, you see another great resurgence of the Disney fortunes, and again, I think it's no coincidence that this is the period of the Cold War, as it begins to, I guess, ironically heat up in that decade. And what you see in the 50s, I think, in many, many ways, is a kind of Cold War culture being expressed in celluloid by the Disney studio. The Davy Crockett films and television show, for example, where Fess Parker, as Davy Crockett, with his trusty rifle at his side, is out there fighting for American ideals and American freedoms and so on. Very reflective, I think, of the political inclinations of that age. You see the Mickey Mouse Club in the 50s as well, creating a very sentimental picture in many ways of American family life and family values, another issue dear to the hearts of Americans in this contest with international communism, et cetera, et cetera. So again, I think a clear kind of historical resonance there.
never be able to watch Davy Crockett again without thinking about it. But now, I noticed Bess Barker seems to have reviewed your book, or at least read it, because you have a quote, or your publicist has a quote from him calling your book as true a picture as I could have imagined. Did you actually get to meet Bess Barker?
Well, I did indeed. I was fortunate to do a fairly good number of interviews for this book, and Barker was one of them, and I spent the afternoon talking to him at his ranch. Well, actually, it's a winery as well up near Santa Barbara. And actually, Fess Parker is a very, very shrewd fellow, and it turned out he had a history degree from the University of Texas, and a very smart guy, so we ended up having a really fascinating conversation about history and the kind of context for the Crockett films and shows of the 1950s, and he turned out to be, I think, one of the two or three best interviews I did for this book, and thought so highly of it, he kindly lent a little blurb for the back cover. I was delighted.
Great. Fess Parker owning a winery? Well, okay.
He's invested his money wisely.
I guess. And a history degree. We may have to get him on this program at some point. You also had the book reviewed, I understand, by Roy Disney. I assume now that's the nephew of
Roy. Right. It's Roy E. Disney, who was the son of Roy O. Disney, who was Walt Disney's brother. The older Roy had been the business manager of the studio for many years and just at the very heart of the Disney growth during this whole period. And I interviewed Roy E. Disney, the younger son, still involved with the studio, at great length for the little biographical sketch of his father I did in the book. And he ended up reading the manuscript and thought very highly of it as well, so ended up cooperating with us.
Great, very good. What? Let's just finish our scheme here. We started earlier. What happened in the 60s? What examples can you use in the 60s of sort of critiques of the social order?
Well, I guess by the 1960s, and really this had begun in the 50s, I think Disney and his work had become more conservative, politically and culturally both. And what you saw by the 60s, I think, was Walt Disney envisioning his work increasingly as a kind of maintenance of the social order as opposed to critiquing it strongly as he had done more in the 1930s. And what you saw in the 60s was Walt's great vision was for the Epcot project in Florida, which he envisioned as a project of urban social reform, rather different from what they have ended up building down there. And he really did plan at great length a kind of utopian city that would take advantage of American technology and sort of latest up-to-date kinds of techniques for urban living and systems development and so on. And he really thought that at Epcot he could create a kind of model for saving American cities down the line. And unfortunately his death cut short his plan and things went down a different path, but I think even at the end of his life, Walt Disney was very much, I think, in his heart involved in the kind of historical development of the American Republic and, at least to his own likes, trying to move it in a certain direction.
Was this reflected in his films also during the 60s? Or?
Well, less and less, I think, and Walt himself grew less interested in the movies and even television as well. He sort of turned it over to his underlings by the 1960s. His real heart was in the development of the theme parks and of the Florida project and of things like audio animatronics, the robot technology that had been developed at the 64 World's Fair. So his own personal interest, I think, was moving beyond the films to these other areas. I think he had become a little bored with the movies, frankly, by the 1960s.
Okay. Well, in the 60s, as you mentioned in your book, I think it was 1968, Richard Schickel's book comes out, kind of a bombshell. What really created problems? What was that all about?
Well, Schickel, a film reviewer for Time and Life magazine, wrote an extremely controversial book on Walt Disney called The Disney Version, in which he basically painted Walt Disney as the creator of a kind of cultural horror. I believe he called it at one point and said that Disney had become a kind of bastion for the subliterates of American society, and that basically he was kind of a huckster, a businessman, and not not an artist and that he had created a kind of escapist world for Americans to run away into. This book, which I think expressed a view widely shared by many intellectuals, just denounced Disney at every turn and created an enormous controversy, as you might imagine, with people lining up on one side of the line or another, defending Disney, attacking Schickel, and vice versa. So it was something of a bombshell, I think, in the Disney community particularly.
Wow. Well, what did you conclude from all this? What's your view? Do you agree with Schickel? Do you see it differently? What's your view of Disney? Is he a huckster or a purveyor of innocence? Where does he stand?
Well, I think sort of neither and both. The position that I ended up trying to articulate was one between what I called, on the one hand, the Disney denouncers, like Richard Schickel, and on the other hand, a group I've taken to calling the Disney disciples, who see Disney as representative of everything that's good and fine in life. To me, the great significance of Walt Disney lay in the way that, number one, he had a kind of instinctive connection, I think, to ordinary Americans and their aspirations and their values. And secondly, I guess, the way in which Disney, I think, helped those Americans come to terms with a rapidly changing society in the 20th century, from the Great Depression up through the Cold War and on into the 1960s. I think he was a kind of mirror of American life. And I guess the conclusion I came to, as I like to put it, is that to understand the American century in the modern world is to understand Walt Disney. And that, for me, is the real significance of this figure.
Well, that does come through in the book, and it certainly makes it a very good book to read because it goes beyond just the biographical details. But we have about 30 seconds left. Just very quickly, tell me about Mickey Mouse. How does he become a social critique here?
Well, Mickey Mouse, if you look at the early Mickey's films back in the late 20s and 30s, he's not exactly the lovable, sentimental Mickey that we have become familiar with, but he's very much a scamp who is always trying to survive terrible things that are happening to him one way or another. He is a kind of representative, I think, much like a Chaplin figure would be, of the little guy and the survival of the little guy in this period. And again, I think this is resonant of the Great Depression and similar attempts by little guys all over the country to make it through things and to survive.
Great. Okay, thanks, Steve, for being with us. I hope you'll join us again soon.
It's a great pleasure, Brian.
Great. You've been listening to Stephen Watts, author of The Magic Kingdom, Walt Disney and the American Way of Life, published by Houghton Mifflin. And you are listening to Talking History. For this week's radio op-ed piece, that segment in which we ask historians to provide their perspective on items in the news, we're pleased to have with us Clark Davis. Dr. Davis is a professor of history at La Sierra University and co-director of the Los Angeles History Research Group at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Living on the Ladder, White Collar Men and the Building of Corporate Cultures in Los Angeles, 1892-1941. Professor Davis's op-ed piece for today is Downsizing Becomes Normal.
Corporate downsizing proved to be one aspect of American life unaffected by El Nino this winter. Massive layoffs continued, unfazed by weather, criticism, or the economy. The rash of downsizing throughout the 1990s represents a watershed in American experience. Layoffs have ripped the fabric of middle-class security by unraveling a 75-year-old contract between big business and employees that promised secure futures in return for loyal service. Recent cuts have stung thousands of Americans who feel betrayed by their employers. Layoffs provoke particular outrage because they break an implicit agreement widely promoted in American corporations throughout the 20th century that dedicated employees would receive cradle-to-grave security. Job security first became a lure of corporate employment in the 1910s as growing firms cultivated vast ranks of salaried workers. Executives confronted a difficult challenge because the young men they sought for salaried posts viewed employment and big business with disdain. Being a man meant having one's own business, trade, or profession. Executives responded by developing corporate cultures based on the one thing big business could provide that other careers could not, security. Leading firms began offering a variety of fringe benefits and a chance to climb the corporate ladder. Even amid the Great Depression, the nation's largest firms terminated salaried employees only as a last resort. Most companies implemented pay cuts and shortened work weeks, but sought to retain the ranks of their workers. By the post-war era, salaried work meant middle-class security. Americans began to feel the pinch of corporate belt tightening in the 1970s, but it was not until the early 1990s when wholesale layoffs became standard practice and generated significant anger. Furor peaked in 1996 when Newsweek's Corporate Killers issue featured menacing photographs of four executives and the number each had laid off. Weeks later, CBS 60 Minutes reporter Leslie Stahl cornered AT&T chief Robert Allen, demanding to know why the suddenly nervous and shaken-looking boss had raised his salary while eliminating those of thousands of subordinates. While still tragic to those who received termination notices, this winter's downsizings have produced less outrage. Media coverage has generally ignored the plight of workers and focused instead on industry health. For most of the 20th century, American firms kept a bargain initially struck with a generation dubious about the corporate order. The 1990s, however, will be remembered as the decade in which that contract was broken. Work security is no longer an unwritten clause in the job description of salaried personnel. Downsizing has become a normal part of life, and Americans will have to find new avenues to ensure middle-class security.
You've been listening to Clark Davis, Professor of History and Co-Director of the Los Angeles History Research Group at the Huntington Library. And finally, our list of coming attractions, upcoming films, television programs, or anything else that may be of interest to our listeners. The streets of Old Sturbridge Village, Massachusetts, will be filled with entertainment on August 8th. The Historical Museum Celebration will feature Colonial New England's music, song, and dance. And coming to Vancouver, Washington, is the 39th annual Evergreen Fly-In. On August 14th through the 16th, aviation enthusiasts will be able to see a variety of 1930s-era antique warbirds taking part in biplane rides and watch flybys. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have any comments, please send them along to us at talkinghistory@creighton.edu, or you can send it by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau, leaving you with one last selection from the soundtrack of Disney's Fantasia.